This is an ABC podcast.
Nissan Bolivinaka, hello Lengeta, Yorana, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up on the show, can French Overseas Minister salvage the historical Bougival Accord?
The agreement was presented really as a draft agreement, and it didn't reflect some of the things that the FLNKS coalition had put forward to France. And how Mr. Valls deals with this will really determine whether we've got a peaceful continuation of the process in the coming months.
And we continue our coverage on Samoa's upcoming elections, and we highlight the role of women in leadership.
The mayor's election as the first woman prime minister of Samoa, it's a milestone for women. Her rise to power was kind of expected.
And today, we also celebrate World Humanitarian Day. All that and more coming your way. But I'm your host, Aggie Thubol. I say vinaka. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. First to New Caledonia, where France's overseas minister, Manuel Valls, is arriving today in a bid to salvage the historic Bougival Accord. New Caledonia's main pro-independence coalition, the FLNKS, has rejected the draft agreement that would see the Pacific archipelago become a French state. The deal was agreed to in July, but both pro-independence and French loyalist parties have been unhappy with the terms. Former Australian Consul General to Noumea, Denise Fisher, says Manuel Valls faces tough negotiations this week.
I think the first thing to say is that this is not just a disagreement with the agreement from a minor party. The FLNKS is the major independence coalition, and the core party which is propelling this opposition is the Union Caledonienne, which is the oldest political party in New Caledonia and the core of the independence coalition. And along with them, some union groups and some church groups have thrown their support behind opposition. So it's quite an important change. And it's important because at the same time as opposing this, this part of the coalition is also replacing its leadership and with the leader Christian Terrin, who has just been released from detention in France because he was accused of a role in inciting violence last year. He was the person who led the organised opposition last year to French unilateral action, which degenerated into violence. So that adds to the concern of people in New Caledonia that if this person has now been placed at the head of the independence coalition's delegation, what does that mean for the future? So that's the first thing that's very uncertain. The second thing is that the French minister responsible for coordinating moving forward on the Bougival Accord, Monsieur Manuel Valls, is arriving to move forward discussions on implementing the Bougival Accord. Now, he has said that despite this expression of opposition by the FLNKS coalition, he is still committed. He's going to move forward. He's going to talk to listen to everybody, listen to their concerns. And he's going to be heading a committee on Wednesday. And he's saying it is possible that we can do further clarification, perhaps on those issues of concern, issues that the FLNKS coalition have said they're opposed to. So there is some scope for him to listen and perhaps persuade the other parties of accommodating some of those concerns. But he has also said that it's not up for renegotiation. This is it, you know. So it's going to be a very, very difficult task for France to negotiate in the face of this opposition.
And from me personally, looking at this, it seems that the FLNKS wants nothing less than independence, and that's why the negotiations are difficult for France. Is that accurate?
Well, the reason, yes, I hear what you're saying. The reasons they have put forward for their concern and their opposition is certainly that they are committed to a path to full sovereignty and they do not see the Bougival Accord as answering this. They also say that it doesn't respect Kanak identity. You know, one of the parties in the coalition has pointed out that You know, the word Kanak is not mentioned once in the Bougival Accord. Then other concerns have been that even though the Bougival Accord promises a process under which one can, the New Caledonia can acquire more sovereign responsibilities, it is only with almost two-thirds of a vote of a Congress which will be voted on, which will be elected by a broader electoral body. In other words, on the basis of increasing voter eligibility, which was the very issue which brought the violence last year. So there are very specific concerns that they have mentioned. And yes, they have very serious concerns about this. There is also floating around the suggestion, especially from Mr. Chibao, who was their negotiator in Bougival, that the agreement isn't really what he expected. He sees that it was presented really as a draft agreement, he says, and it didn't reflect some of the things that the FLNKS coalition had put forward to France. For example, a Kanaki Accord, which they have proposed for some years now. And the coalition itself refers to its own deadlines of the 24th of September this year, where they had hoped to announce a new Kanaki. So it seems that the two calendars, the two timetables, are very different. And how Mr. Valls deals with this will really determine whether we've got a peaceful continuation of the process in the coming months.
The majority of Kanaks want independence, and France has come under a lot of criticism for continuing to be a colonial power. Why is it in the interests of France to keep New Caledonia as a colony?
France has a great attachment to its territories overseas. It has 13 overseas territories. There are many reasons why it would want to hang on, especially to New Caledonia, which is seen as one of the preeminent of its overseas territories. It has a foothold in the Pacific region. Mr. Macron has announced a major Indo-Pacific vision for France, where France is to take a role in the Indo-Pacific based on its sovereignty in the various territories that it possesses. And really, it is New Caledonia which is the first and important test, because it has definitely got a very strong independence movement. You mentioned the Kanaks. Certainly their support for independence has been measured in recent years with the three independence referendums, all of which resulted in a vote for staying with France, but with very large proportions and significant, as you say, significant percentage on an ethnic basis of Kanak indigenous people supporting independence over those three referendums. So all of those votes did demonstrate strong indigenous and islander, not just Kanak, but islander support within New Caledonia for independence. Under the Bougival Agreement, there will be another referendum. It will be in February, and it will be on the basis of the Bougival Accord. So there is an opportunity in February for all those who voted in those three referendums to go back to the polls and to express a view on this. And of course, the risk is that, what will that vote be? Will it be a rejection or will it be an endorsement? So this is the big question now.
And that was former Australian Consul General to Noumea, Denise Fisher, speaking to reporter Finel Funua.
Join Sose Fomoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thubol. Now, Samoa is heading to the polls later this month following a snap election called after Fiamea Naomi Mataafa's government lost support in Parliament. It's a pivotal moment for Samoa's first woman Prime Minister, who has already left her mark on the nation's politics, from steering the country through the turbulence of the 2021 constitutional crises to championing climate action on the global stage. But Fiamea's political career has come come under heavy scrutiny and faced many challenges, from being sworn into office in a tent after being locked out of Parliament, facing two votes of no confidence, and being heckled in Parliament about not being married. I spoke with Professor Tuiloma Susana Tawa'a from the National University of Samoa about Fiamea's time in office so far and what this election could mean for women in leadership and for Samoa's future.
Samoa was once the darling of the donor community. 40 years, Samoa was praised by our development partners as a model state, stable democracy, despite functioning effectively as a one-party state for over four decades. That's the only party I grew up with, 1982, under the HRPP. So, fast forward now, the recent political developments have put this reputation to the test, raising questions about the validity and sustainability of earlier assessment with stability that is related to a one-party state, and reflects a very complex entanglement of culture, the Faamatai system, the church and the state, an amalgamation that challenges the foundational principles of a genuine democratic system. Relationships are fundamental to Samoan politics, and these relationships are deeply rooted in our cultural values, fa'aloalo, respect, mamalu, dignity, and alofa, care and compassion and love. But in recent years, these values appear to be eroding under the pressures of modern political dynamics, including increased partisanship, personal ambition, external influences. So, and as a result, political relationships that were once built on trust, reciprocity, you know, are now more transactional.
Professor, when we look at modern day politics, in the last few years, Samoa saw their first female prime minister. Do you think the country was ready for this? Do you think they still want her in power?
I think we did a specific attitude survey in 2020. When the results tell a story, you know, of attitudes towards women in politics and decision making that were generally positive. Would you like to see a woman prime minister, a woman PM? And, you know, overwhelmingly, the response was positive. First party was actually putting forward Fiamea as the leader. However, that support did not extend to roles that are perceived as more traditional roles, such as head of state, village leadership. So, yes, we were very much for having a woman PM at the time, but when we asked the same question regarding traditional roles such as the head of state or village leadership, there was a bit of a reluctance. So thinking about it now, maybe we weren't ready for a female leader. Now, Fiamea's election as the first woman prime minister of Samoa, it's a milestone for women and gender equality. However, her path to leadership is quite different from what most women and men typically will experience in their lifetime, because Fiamea is the head of one of Samoa's traditional families, Salivalasi. She's the daughter of the country's first prime minister. So she was born into a position of privilege and leadership. Her rise to power was kind of expected. It was shaped by her lineage, social status, and upbringing. So for the rest of the other women, it's going to be a struggle for most women who are brave enough and willing to contest seats.
Fiamea's journey has not been the smoothest since being elected, but since she became prime minister, do you believe she's been able to fulfill the promises, if any, that her and the FAST party intended?
Well, before she was PM and a fast leader, she was the deputy prime minister under the previous government, HRPP. So she had that advantage. She was in there in the formulation of many of these policies under HRPP. Then she left and she came the leader and prime minister, Ilalule Fast. It's not as if she was not fresh parliamentarian or politician. So I suppose that is a strength. So got to give it to Fia Mayor for seeing that through, for continuation and sustainability.
Professor, if we look at women in politics throughout the history, and even now in Samoa, how important is it to have women in these roles of leadership?
We have been in history, Samoan women, you know, being underrepresented in parliaments and in cabinets. And this marginalization from politics is kind of reinforced by the Matai only eligibility rule. 3% of adult women in Samoa are Matai title holders compared to 28% of men. I would prefer to be elected on merit. In Samoa, I think the quota system now is widely accepted because it can mean the difference between being in power.
When we look to the women of Samoa, are they generally out there ready to cast their vote?
Yeah, well, that's another good question. You have to register to vote. I think they really need to be encouraged. There's laid back attitude. And that is reflected also in results. So again, the younger generation, that your vote is your voice.
Just finally though, Professor, for the upcoming snap election, what are you expecting?
From the talk and the Talanoa conversations, you know, family, village, you have civil societies, it seems like the vote is kind of determined by what's in it for me. If I vote, which party should I vote for? It's not priority so that we have a gender equality, a representation of men and women and etc. But I know gender is important. Utangata Uma Yamanuia includes the elderly, young children, poor youth, you know, single mothers, etc. And that would actually, I suppose, meet gendered aspects of development and representation.
And that there is Professor Tuilomba Susana Tawa'a from the National University of Samoa. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time we head around the region and get the latest from your news wrap and your headlines. That's brought to you by producer Carl Evans. Good morning, sir. How you doing?
I'm well, Aggie. How are you today?
good. As always, bright and early. And you've got the stories for us this morning. Really interesting on this first one, though. In Fiji, looks like the government is considering putting restrictions on Facebook and YouTube. It sounds like the end of the world.
Yeah, that's right, Aggie. So Fiji's exploring tighter regulation of social media amid rising concerns over misinformation and online harm of, yeah, never heard that one before. No, wink, wink. That's according to the Communications Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, who said the government was studying Australia's and Malaysia's approaches to see how a similar program might work in Fiji. Details are scarce at this stage, but the Deputy PM said the bans could be targeted at young people, mentioning Facebook and YouTube specifically. That being said, any policy is still very much in its infancy and will be debated over the next 12 months before anything becomes concrete. He also said any approach would be balanced to ensure both freedom of speech and public safety is taken into account. But, God, you know, with the way things are moving at the moment, you know, it'll be AI is going to be in charge of everything by then, I imagine. So
very
it'll probably be
so.
A different issue.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll wait and hear on how that goes. But we head to the Northern Mariana Islands. Congress delegate is actually calling for President Trump to release documents related to Amelia Earhart.
Yeah, very interesting one, this one as well. So that decades-old mystery surrounding her fate may be one step closer to resolution, thanks to CNMI delegate Kimberly King-Hines. She's made a formal request for President Trump to declassify federal documents related to her disappearance. As we know, she disappeared over the Pacific Ocean while trying to circumnavigate the world way back in 1937, sparking a long-lasting mystery as well as several conspiracy theories as to why she might have disappeared. And her story carries particular weight in the CNMI, according to Ms. King-Hines. A number of elderly residents apparently still recall her presence in the Pacific, with some sharing credible first-hand accounts of having seen her on the island of Saipan. And that does feed into one particular theory that she and her navigator, Fred Noonan, may have been captured by Japanese forces and brought to Saipan, who ruled the island at that time. So so who knows? This could be a turning point in one of the world's greatest unsolved mysteries, or it might just confuse us all more. But do you have any theories, Aggie?
No, I still am on the same theory that she did disappear somewhere over the Pacific Ocean. Where as to where specifically? I wouldn't have a clue.
It's so vast, isn't it?
A little bit. Okay. Hey, this is a really interesting story. Some huge rugby league news for Samoa. What's happening here?
Yeah, so Brisbane and New South Wales Origin pop Payne Haas has committed his allegiances to Toa Samoa in what's a huge boost for their Pacific Championships and World Cup campaigns over the coming months. So he revealed his decision on Nine's Wide World of Sports yesterday. Let's have a listen.
There was a moment when I played for Australia, when we versus Samoa in Townsville, and the anthems were playing, and my mind started racing back. Lots of memories with my mum making us sing the national anthem for Samoa a lot. I think from that moment onwards, I wanted to play for Samoa and represent my mum's side, the Tofua side, and really make them proud.
It was a hard one, to be honest. I've been torn and throwing for about 2 years now, since 2023, since I played the last pack chance for Australia, and I think the moment what made me move was the national anthem. Nearly got teary, to be honest. All these memories came back. It was me and my brothers, especially my brother Chase. My mum used to make us sing the national anthem at the back of the car, and yeah, I just seen Chase's face pop up and Cleese, and we're all sitting at the back, and it's something I've always wanted to do, to honour my grandparents and my mum's side, and I get the chance to do that now, and I'm content with my decision.
Very raw and very honest from Payne Haas. It's a huge thing for so many reasons. At the moment, he is widely considered to be the best prop in the game. And just after that emotional revelation, he really came out firing and said Samoa could beat Australia at the World Cup next year. I think they could have beaten them at the last World Cup, to be honest, Aggie, on their day. And look, obviously very brave as well to speak about, you know, that cultural identity conflict that he was feeling, particularly having to listen to the Australian national anthem and sing that while, you know,
your homeland
is standing right opposite you. I imagine that's probably something a lot of Pacific Islanders can relate to and be proud of.
Oh, I think so. And I do recall in one of his speeches, I don't know if it was specifically that one, but he had even mentioned, you know, that whole where the wave started when Jason Tamalolo, you know, decided to play for Tonga. So he goes, there's been a bit of a ripple effect since then for all these guys wanting to go and play for their homeland. So kudos to him. Well done. Okay. Finally, though, the PNG Hunters, they've made a big, huge bid towards finals footy in the Queensland Cup.
Yes, a really good win over the weekend. 52-32 victory over the South Logan Magpies in round 21 of the Hose Plus Cup at the Santos National Football Stadium. They led throughout. It was 28-10 at the break, led mainly by star winger Solo Wane, who was outstanding. He crossed for four tries. Menasea Kai also bagged a double, and Clint Lamar was absolutely clinical with the boot. So, yeah, look, really good win over the Magpies, to be fair, they were below the Hunters on the ladder, but they're no slouches. Like, they actually had Anthony Milford playing for them, who I still remember the days. Yes. He was an absolute NRL superstar. That win elevates them to seventh now with two rounds to play, both of which will come on the road against the Seagulls and the Pride. But if they can win one of those games, I think they're all but cemented to play finals footy.
Nice. Well done, PNG Hunters. And as always, Kyle, thank you very much for coming through with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you.
Well, today, it's World Humanitarian Day, a moment to recognise the courage and commitment of those working on the front lines of crises across the globe. And in the Pacific, humanitarianism often takes a unique form, rooted in community resilience, cultural connection, and responding to disasters that are becoming more frequent and severe. So joining me now to reflect on this is Lavinia Mahit, Save the Children Vanuatu's Director of Programs. She's been at the forefront of emergency responses in Vanuatu, including last December's earthquake when she stepped in as acting country director. With that, I say welcome, Lavinia, to the show.
Talofa, Aggie. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, off the bat, when you think about being a humanitarian in the Pacific, what does that sort of mean to you personally and professionally?
Firstly, thank you for having me, Aggie, and thanks also for the question. You know, being a humanitarian, it's all about serving the community. And personally and professionally, I'd say it's no different to my similar work in New Zealand in the past, where I was a police officer with the New Zealand Police. So it's all about that community needs and putting the community first and responding to, you know, what help is needed at that time. Except this time in the Pacific, in my current role, with Save the Children, it's putting the children at the center of our work. And as you're aware, Aggie, when we zoom into Vanuatu, Vanuatu is the most disaster-prone country in the world. And each year, every 6 months, we are on the verge of facing things like cyclones. Except last year, as you mentioned, we didn't get a cyclone, but we got a deadly earthquake, which claimed lives of 14 people and affected somewhat 80,000 people. So days like today, World Humanitarian Day, is a great reminder and also a global celebration of people helping people and the recognition of the amazing humanitarian work that's done around the world and how these workers risk their lives to support children in the communities.
Mm-mm. And look, as you mentioned about that, you know, major earthquake in December in Vanuatu, you were involved, you know, responding to that major emergency. Can you maybe share what that experience was like on the ground?
Yeah, sure. So the earthquake was a scary and unique experience, you know, not like cyclones where we get advance notice. We can prepare days in advance and there's different alert systems that get everyone ready. This one was, it was a surprise. I was 2 days into my new interim role acting as a country director, like you mentioned. So what was meant to be a short, quiet time, you know, looking forward to Christmas with loved ones, winding down the year, flipped 180 degrees on Tuesday, 17 December, during our lunch break. So we were on top of a building in the CBD in town. We were on level 3 and 4 of the building. And when the earthquake happened, everyone just rushed out as they should. And I cleared both floors. And once I exited the building to accompany my staff members, my colleagues outside, we were making our way to higher grounds. And there were members of the public that walked past in a rush to say, and pointed back to the Billabong building that has collapsed. And they were saying people had died there. There were kids that were injured. There were children with blood on their arms. And it was a very distressful time. And that was when I knew we were faced with something big and we needed to activate our humanitarian response mode. So it was a scary and unique experience. Immediate impacts to children that I saw, and even to my own children, was the trauma that was there, not only on the actual earthquake, Aggie, but also consequently and after the earthquake as well, the aftershocks that kept us on the edge that contributed to the trauma that children were facing. And so there were damaged buildings, some that collapsed right through the grounds. There were landslides that affected our nice, beautiful greenery, turning the mountains and the ridges into muddy and dangerous rocky landslides. There were lots of unimaginable loss, but through it all, our teams, our staff, including our volunteers alike, we all stood strong and supported each other and the white community, and especially aligning our work closely with the National Disaster Management Office, so the government who led the response. And everyone just went above and beyond, ensuring that children and families received the care, protection, and support they need. But just before I finish on this question, Abby, one thing I want to highlight is that, you know, I want to take time to honor and thank our immediate families, because without their support and, you know, holding the fort, holding the household down, we humanitarian workers can't leave the house to do this important work that we are so called to do. So first and foremost, I want to also acknowledge our families that let us do this and that understand this role and the commitment we do. So, I just wanted to point that out, that while it is humanitarian day, our families also play a huge part in that, playing that support system role.
Yeah, which really would lead me to, you know, this next question, and the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, you know, how much Vanuatu faces cyclones, volcanic eruptions, and now these earthquakes. How do communities' own strengths and traditions really shape the humanitarian response there?
So in times of crisis and disasters, as we've seen, our communities in Vanuatu come together a lot, but also in peacetime, we have a communal way of life and living and lifestyle. But from the ancestors and back to today, we've seen and we've learned that there are signs and signals that show community members when a cyclone is about to hit. So there's things we see in nature that play a vital role to indicate, you know, if there's a cyclone coming. So then we lean on or build community strengths and traditions to shape the way we respond. And also through our projects, we've said the children, we ensure that we have localization embedded one way or another, and also sustainability of these projects. And we do things like capacity building with community members to help them feel empowered to stand on their own, so that once project ends, they don't rely on donor funding too much, but they rely on the inner strengths and the traditions that shape them and are valuable to their day-to-day lives. And they know best. So giving that power back to the community, they know best how to respond according to their own context. And one of the work that we do is through one of the biggest climate adaptation projects known as the Vanuatu Community-Based Climate Resilience, and that's throughout the whole six provinces. And that's very much community-led. We're just there to provide advice or technicality when need be, but we uphold and we empower localization through our projects and give power back to the people on the grassroots level especially, and just help or plug gaps where we need to when it comes to technical expertise.
Of course. And look, Lavinia, it sounds like amazing work that you're doing. We just want to say thank you very much for the work that you are doing out there. But look, that's all the time that we have for this morning. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Agi. Mala pito. Have
Thank
a nice
you.
Day.
You too. That was Lavinia Mahit from Save the Children Vanuatu.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Aggie, how are you going?
Yeah, mala lele. It's good to catch up with you guys. Shouldn't say guys, I should say men, eh?
Yeah, we're big boys.
You know what I mean?
We're adults.
I haven't been described as a man for some time now. All right, I am a guy.
Okay. I'm always good to know.
We're chilling.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, a fresh spotlight was shone over the history books last week to mark the 80th anniversary of the Japanese surrender in the Pacific. But even after 80 years, new details are still emerging, including some about a special Australian unit which featured six Solomon Islands soldiers. It was called the Special Reconnaissance Unit. It was the brainchild of an Australian anthropologist turned army officer named Donald Thompson, and its job was to protect the north coast of Australia from Japanese forces. As for what became of them is anyone's guess. However, Army Fellow at the Australian War Memorial, Major Samuel White, is trying to find out, and he spoke about it with Carl Evans.
The Special Reconnaissance Unit was tasked after a letter that Thompson wrote suggesting that it was possible with taking the best warriors from Arnhem Land and patrolling the coast of Arnhem Land, not in the way that they would sit and fight, you know, in a pitched battle, but because they were able to be completely independent within Arnhem Land, you didn't have to resupply with food or with weapons. These men were taught how to identify Japanese officers and how to kill them. They were taught how to identify Japanese aircraft and how to call it in on the radio, even to the point where they had Molotov cocktails. And that was the only Western weapon that the men were given or wanted to have, was these Molotov cocktails that they could throw at tanks if they landed on the beach. That was the task of the unit. Now, that unit didn't see any action, but for 2 years they patrolled Arnhem Land, keeping an eye to see whether or not the Japanese landed. And in fact, they are the precursor to the unit that still exists there today, the Arnhem Squadron, which is part of Norforce. It's the grandsons and the granddaughters serving the same unit as the grandfathers.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. I understand you've put their story in the newspapers in the Solomon Islands to get an idea of people who might have known them or who might have been related to them. What's the response been like?
Yeah, the response has been more than I hoped that it would be. So it might be worth just saying, though, that these six men Donald Thompson personally requested them to join, and we think that's because Thompson had served in the Solomons during World War II with Coast Watchers. We don't know how Thompson knew these men by name, but what we have in some of the letters that went from Australia to the Solomons and via the High Commission, Deputy Prime Minister of Australia was brought in at one point, was that these six men were requested specifically. And some of the Solomon Islanders came back and said, oh, does it have to be them? And the answer was yes, it had to be them. So these six men were there to help the Yolngu understand, I think, how to identify Japanese aircraft, because I think they were coast watchers. We don't have any formal documents that show that, but they must have had some experience already in the Solomon Islands. These six men came from different islands. So there was Private Tiki, Private Gege, Private Papai, Private Macau, Private Edward Richardson, and a Private Talzia, who discharged earlier in the piece. We're not quite sure why he went home early. Perhaps he was sick. But of those six men that joined, five ended up serving in Arnhem Land. And we see them in the photos. They're often there side by side with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander troops. In terms of the feedback that we've had, I've had about five or six grandchildren of Private Macau from Palau, and they've reached out. We know that his medal is still in the family. One of the reverends who works in Solomon Islands has reached out about a descendant of Private Tiki. But that's been it so far. We're really keen to see where the other four ended up and to get their story as well.
Yeah, it's incredible that they were handpicked specifically. Does that mean that they might have served in like the Battle of Guadalcanal or something like that?
I don't think they were in Guadalcanal, but I do think that they would have been part of Coast Watchers with Donald Thompson. And I think that's probably what brought them from all the different islands together. Mm. If we can get access to those records, we can confirm that. But theirs is a very unique part of Solomon Islander military history because they are enlisted in the Australian Army, right? Like they're not just seconded. They have a regimental number. They are paid as Australian troops. They are given Australian medals and they're entitled to, you know, veteran status from Australia. Unlike perhaps the Coast Watchers or people that remained within the British Solomon Islands at the time, these are Australian troops and the Yolngu War Memorial is trying to tell their story.
And just finally, you know, if you can figure that out, what do you hope to do with the, you know, with the information and the details once you have them confirmed?
So we have these photos from the Donald Thompson collection, and they're owned by the University of Melbourne, but they've been very kindly, they're allowing us to use them at the Australian War Memorial. What I'd like to do is to be able to have those photos at the War Memorial online in a way that anyone can access it across the world, and to have the stories of the grandchildren of these men explaining their grandfather so that anyone can listen and anyone can read the story of their grandparents. We also have a book coming out with the University of Melbourne Press where we're looking at both the history of the Northern Territory Special Reconnaissance Unit and with the photos from the Thompson Collection. We're looking at the history of when Milangimbi was bombed and there was a boat called the Patricia Cam. It was sunk and some Yolngu men saved a lot of the Ballander sailors. And I want to have a chapter in there which talks specifically about the Solomon Islander history. So that is what we're working towards, a free-to-download or a free-to-access book where we can tell the next step in this history of the men.
And that is Army Fellow at the Australian War Memorial, Major Samuel White, and he was speaking with Carl Evans.
Pacific Beat.
Well, we're taking you now out into the Pacific Ocean, where the National Geographic's Pristine Seas Expedition vessel is on a mission to uncover hidden marine treasures in deep ocean ecosystems. Now, since April, the Pristine Seas has been on a huge expedition through Fiji, Rotuma and Tuvalu, researching and documenting the Pacific's sea life. It's the first time Fiji's deep sea and outer open deep sea is being seen and documented. And on board right now is our very own reporter, Lide Movono. There I say, good morning on the high seas there, Lide, Yandra.
Yandra Vinaka, and I think Ola as well as Mbula and Malalele is the order of the morning here, Aggie. It's so good to be coming to you from the Argo, the yes. National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition Vessel.
I love it. Look, the Pristines, we know, Lide, has been traveling, right, for months documenting the Pacific Ocean. What is it doing at the moment, though, while you are on board?
Well, right this minute, it's so exciting to be able to say to you that I am sitting right next to Dr. Choeli Vitayaki and Cyrus Gander of Blue Prosperity Fiji, who are about to become only the second and third Fijians to go down to the bottom of the ocean in the Argonaut. Aggie, the Argonaut is a submersible. It's more or less a tiny submarine that fits three people, and they're going to go to the bottom of the ocean. Right now, it's part of the expedition's focus on Fiji, outer ocean, a part of the deep blue that very many of us in the Pacific, you know anything about. A lot of us being coastal people, you know, being people of the ocean, we tend to forget that right there, just beyond the horizon, in the bottom, the very deepest part of our planet is also our heritage and our identity. So the National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition is here at the invitation of the government to look at that part of the ocean. But they're working with Blue Prosperity Fiji. It's a nonprofit that's embedded within Fiji's government. And the idea is that they will get data that Aggie has never been seen before, never been captured before, that will shape Fiji's ability to protect its marine resources. It's a really critical part of getting Fiji to protect at least 30 of its ocean by 2030, Aggie.
Wow. And I understand also, though, Lide, that yesterday you got to head like 70 meters underwater in the Yasawas Islands in that submersible. Like, what did you get to see down there?
Oh my gosh. I guess you'll have not come up with the words, but what I saw made me feel connected to the ocean in a way that I never expected to. Mm. I saw what you expect to see, you know, fish and coral, but with your own eyes in its natural element, fish moving the way it's meant to and not at the end of a fishing line, coral swaying away in the current of the ocean with no disturbance from man. It was an explosion of emotions for me, Aggie. It was so hard to contain my need to cry at this beauty that I was seeing. Mm. But what I didn't expect is that feeling of realizing these are living things in their homes that are being threatened by us, by the things that we do and the things that we need to get from the bottom of the ocean. So it was absolutely exhilarating, but also, Agnes, just so beautiful seeing, you know, seeing the world from that perspective, being underneath of the ocean inside of this $6 million equipment that is being used for research, where you're looking back up at the world. It is an absolutely exhilarating experience. I have never felt and experienced anything like this. It is simply the most favorite experiences of my entire life. It's just so wonderful to be able to say all of these things, Aggie, and to be able to just say with my own experience that there is an entire ecosystem down there that we don't know about and we need to learn about it.
Well, I mean, I can hear the excitement of the experience that you just made.
And this is one day later. I'm still struggling to contain my emotions.
Well, and this is the thing. You've been able to take part in every single deployment and retrieval. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So on the Argo is a group of just under 20 scientists. The bulk of them are from the coastal communities of the United States, but we also have, you know, deep sea experts and researchers from, say, the Americas that are here with us. And we have people who have the experience of deep sea ocean ecosystems here with us. And so what that means is that journalists such as myself who are going onto the open sea for the first time can see firsthand and be part of what it means to capture life at the bottom of the ocean. So all of the scientists on board here are capturing using familiar technology. Well, when I say familiar, I say that loosely because they're using cameras. But these are cameras, Aggie, that can withstand pressure at 6,000 meters at the bottom of the ocean or 1,500. So I'm going out with them in this beautiful, wonderful watercraft crafts that I've never seen in Fiji before. And a lot of them manned, forgive the irony, manned by women. A lot of the boat operators are women. And even that is just so hard to wrap my, you know, my mind around. But going out, taking out heavy cameras with state-of-the-art technology that's invented by National Geographic, by the way, to go down to the bottom of the ocean so that we here in Fiji can see what's down there and can also understand what it is we're protecting or what it is we need to protect. So every day, I'm either on a rib or on a skiff following the scientists and helping them to drop cameras down that can take photographic evidence of what's down there, but also do the scientific data gathering about what's in the deep outer ocean off Fiji. So what's it like to be on board? It is like living in a National Geographic documentary. Wow. I think is the best way to describe that. It is absolutely just out of this world, Aggie.
And I also know the fact that, you know, you'd mentioned earlier, you know, that the submersible is used to document Fiji's deep sea, right? But I'm wondering, will local scientists and even maybe traditional leaders join any of the remaining legs?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, my cabin mate, Sarahs, who is just sitting to the right of me, and Dr. Chai Achoe Livetayaki, who is one of Fiji's foremost marine scientists and has taught, you know, the Pacific's best marine biologist, is sitting to my left. They're already in their suits, because Aggie, you have to wear a special suit. It's almost like being in a spaceship. So they're sitting in their suits, in their prescribed socks and footwear, and just waiting for the submersible, the Argonaut, to be in the right position for them to go down and see under the water. And then tomorrow we exchange with another group of, this time also community conservationists, but traditional resource owners, people who have been working in this space for the longest time, based in their communities. So they too will have the same experience. It is an absolutely wonderful integration of traditional knowledge, local community science, but also brilliant state-of-the-art National Geographic expertise.
Leather, now the pristine seas, right? They've probably found some really incredible things over the years, from like the world's largest known coral in Solomon Islands to the deepest plant ever recorded in the ocean. Have any discoveries been made since you've been on board?
I knew you were going to ask me that question. And as it happens, I've been specifically cautioned to wait for when, you know, the proper scientific verification process can be done and the journals can actually make the announcements. But I can say with some level of certainty, there have been discoveries. There have been new species. I just can't say what. I couldn't pronounce the name anyway if I tried. But in the coming weeks and months, we will get to hear about some of the fish, the beautiful fish, because I've seen the raw footage that's come out from the first dive that happened before the one I went on. And there's so much that needs to be protected down there. There is the beauty, but there's also the fact that we need to understand that we lose a species or two, we throw off the balance of our ecosystem, and that can have a critical impact on the way people in Fiji and across the Pacific can continue to live, you know, on the ocean and from the ocean. So yes, Aggie, I can say there have been discoveries, there's some new species, but you'll have to wait for the scientists to announce that, sadly.
Well, that's all right. Well, Lee, there, look, as we wrap up, I know you've got like a few more days left on board, but what will you be doing and what's really next for Pristine Seas?
Well, now that I've done all of the activities there is to do, from dropping baited cameras to attract sharks and apex predators, and from dropping deep sea cameras to 2,000 meters, for example, and that was actually last night. I've done all of that activity. So now what I'm hoping to see is the people that will come on board next. There's a 1-hour window when we'll be out in the open sea and exchanging local teams. So some of these people are known to us at the ABC. We've written stories about them, and I'm really excited about seeing their excitement and to find out what it is they want to see when they get to the bottom of the ocean or when they work with these scientists that are on board. So other than that, there's so many women on this expedition, Aggie. It's just so baffling to me. I'm hoping to at least sit down with all of them to find out, you know, the how, whys, and how do we get our Pacific women working in the marine science field too, and just being badasses out there on the ocean saving our planet, Aggie. That's the plan.
And, well, look, you are one of those women that are, you know, forging the way as a journalist out in the seas.
And, malo, malo, opito, Aggie.
Yeah, and look, we appreciate it. I mean, you're sounding great from out in the ocean.
Yes, exactly. Thanks to modern technology, we can be everywhere and still be able to share it with the world. It's so good to be on the show with you again, Aggie.
Absolutely. And all the best for the remaining of your travels there out in the Pacific Ocean. Thank you very much. Vinaka Ali there.
Malo, malo.
And that was Lede Movono speaking to me there from out in the Pacific Ocean on board the National Geographic's Pristine Seas Expedition vessel. And she was chatting to me there here on Pacific Beat.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/Pacific and enter your email to join today.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, France's overseas minister Manuel Valls is arriving today in a bid to salvage the historic Bougival Accord after it was rejected by New Caledonia's main pro-independence coalition.
So there is some scope for him to listen and perhaps persuade the other parties of accommodating some of those concerns. But he has also said that it's not up for renegotiation. This is it.
And that was former Australian Consul General to Noumea, Denise Fisher. Well, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference.
Search up ABC Nisha Daily Afternoon Edition to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.